Welcome to the Never Settle podcast. My name is Mel Clark, and I am passionate about helping people realise that settling for second best is no longer an option, and that everyone deserves to live the life they truly desire. Hello. So today I got to chat with the wonderful Morgana Ray. She's a real live wire. Morgana is a money coach, basically. If you've got money blocks, like most of us have, Morgana can sort you out. But even more interesting, she got married for the first time at 47, and her husband are going to get married 100 times. And at the point of this interview, I think we were at 25. Basically, they are having ceremonies all around the world in amazing locations, whether it be official or whether it just be a ceremony for themselves. And I just find that intriguing. They just get to renew their vows all the time and have fun along the way. And it's, for them, it's just, you know, they are soulmates, twin flames, call them what you want, and they absolutely love it. But Morgana is also an international best-selling author, and she basically helps people get rid of their money blocks. And I can relate to that. I've had money blocks most of my life, although I feel like they're leaving me now, which is great. But anyway, Morgana, she sat outside in Costa Rica in this interview, and you can hear the birds and the parrots and God knows what in the background. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful conversation. She's a wonderful person. She's been on lots of big networks and news shows and all the rest of it, sharing her wisdom and knowledge. And it was fantastic to listen to some of that on this podcast. So wherever you are, guys, enjoy. Well, hello, lovely listeners. Today I am speaking to the wonderful Morgana Ray. And just as I started speaking, the bird started singing. So that tells me something. Morgana is a 20-time international best-selling author. She's a mentor and a coach, regarded to be the world's number one authority on relationship with money. Well, I think we could all do with that, couldn't we? We could all do with more help on that. And she has a real fun approach to what can be a scary topic. And this has booked her as an expert on the Wall Street Journal, Yahoo Finance, Fox News, CNN, and all of the major TV networks, including Coast to Coast Radio and lots more. We were just talking a minute ago about how many podcasts and interviews she's done. She has no idea, thousands probably. But she loves helping her clients manifest 5, 6, 7 figure incomes. And something she put in an email to me is that married for the first time at 47 and is now basically, when you wrote this, I don't know whether it's changed, 25 weddings deep into getting married 100 times in 100 countries, and it was 100% her husband's idea. So we'll get to that a bit later. And there's loads more I could say, but you know what? I think it's going to sound better coming from Morgana. So Morgana, who is actually in Costa Rica on vacation and is still doing this podcast with me, what an absolute superstar. Thank you so much. I'm so jealous because it's like grey and miserable here. So
where are you?
I'm in a place called Coventry in England, which is right in the middle of England.
So it's still winter.
It is. We're starting to see some spring flowers now, which is nice. But yeah, nothing like Costa Rica. But welcome, Morgana. It's an absolute pleasure to have you.
So just a warning, I am outdoors right now, kind of by the pool. So there may be noises, like animal noises. I have no idea what's going to come up. Yeah. So if you hear something weird, that's why.
That's cool. I've been doing, because I'm a Reiki healer as well. So I gave a session earlier with all the animal noises and the natural noises just from the iPod, you know, as opposed to actually being outside. So I'm used to it today. So Morgana, I always like to hear more about my guests, a little bit about your backstory, maybe growing up, whatever you feel called to share, but also, you know, how you got into doing what you're doing. I know you've been doing it 20 or so years. 28 years. Wow. Right. So I'd like to know what you did before that, but, and also why 47 getting married, you know, was that a conscious thing or is it just the way it's worked out? So we can get into that. But yeah, over to you. So I'd love to hear a bit more about Little Morgana growing up and how you've got into what you've got into.
Well, I'm 55 now. So some of the good things growing up was excellent children's television, you know, just the birth of Sesame Street and shows I don't know if you had in England, like Zoom. You had the Beatles, we had Sesame Street.
Yeah.
But there was also a lot of chaos in my upbringing. My mother is an addict, maybe bipolar, narcissistic, you know, a lot of labels. It just means that there was a lot of emotional drama and insecurity. At one point in high school, I had just been hit by a car. I had been in a coma. I had this traumatic brain injury. And I spent the senior year of what we call high school in the States, living on people's floors just so that I could graduate, because it wasn't safe at home. So I was actually living for months on the dining room floor of some friends of my father's, because they lived close to my high school. So,
and this was after you'd had a really horrific
Yeah. And it's not that my mom intends to be harmful. She's not a super villain. She's not a bad person. There's just, you know, she did the best she could. She did a lot of good stuff too, but not safe for me because of her own demons. And the reason I bring that up is because here I am all these years later in this very like odd, never really intended niche of money. Like, I majored in religion in college. Then I became an unsuccessful actress. So money was, I actually took the law school admission test because a boyfriend told me it would be stupid to become a religion professor. And I was young and in love. So I believed him. And I scored in the top, 99th percentile, and didn't become a lawyer. And became an actress instead. So money was never my primary focus or my interest or priority. It's always been more stuff like the human condition. And that's where like the religion major and the acting overlap is. It's all about what is it to be human? And how do we work problems out? How do we see this world we live in, and how do we all have a better experience while we're here? And I'm still driven by those questions as a coach. Mm. So that I ended up with the money niche really came out of being so bad at it. Great student, graduated from college, got half a dozen certifications as a coach, had movie star clients, mountains of testimonials, not making money. It's like I have superpowers of money repulsion. And
sorry, you said you had celebrity clients, but still no money.
Yeah. I was helping people without credits, book, primetime TV series, regular movies, awards, selling their first films. I was good at everything except charging and receiving, because all sorts of stuff would come up about, I would just get so much guilt and shame around asking to be paid for helping people, which I sounds ridiculous when I say it, but here's why I'm sharing this. Is those of us who tend to be more motivated by relationship, especially those of us who have codependent tendencies because of difficult parents or whatever. Also, those of us who are like maybe very empathic and intuitive, and we tend to feel other people's experiences as if it's our own. We tend to have fuzzy boundaries. So for me to ask to be paid felt like I was taking money causing harm. And I felt such a very strong, painful repulsion at that I could help people easily for free, sometimes for pocket change. Like at one point for one of my certifications, I was charging like $5 a coaching session. Wow. Just to get the hours in, the paid hours. And then people were having miracles, you know, like booking TV series, getting films, healing their relationships with their dad, stuff like that. So I had a reputation. I had celebrity names. I had this whole thing. But when people wanted to hire me, all of my guilt of like, I have this spiritual gift. I'm intuitive. I can heal people. I connect them and miracles happen. And I felt guilt about taking money for it, which is ridiculous because so what are you supposed to get paid for? Causing harm?
Yeah.
And it didn't matter what I said. People could feel my discomfort. So at a really, the kind of the pivotal point for me was, so here I'm living in Los Angeles. I'm struggling to make $100 a month in Los Angeles, which is like living in London, making $100 a month, paying for everything on credit card, going through my life savings, borrowing, still flying out of town twice a month to get more trainings and more certifications as if that would be the answer. Also taking business classes and marketing classes. And I'm really good at marketing. Part of what people were hiring me for was teaching them how to market themselves in the entertainment industry. And I was so good at that. That's why they wanted me. And I took a class on overcoming sales objections, which is, what do you say when somebody says, oh, I'd love to, but I can't afford it or anything like that. And being like a super good student, I would follow the scripts and overcame the objections of seven people in a row. And seven people in a row didn't show up for our first session and never paid.
Right.
And that was like it for me. Like it, that was, I had taken every class on mindset, every class on getting clients, on marketing, on sales conference. I've taken everything and I had every certification and I live in LA. So I went to tons of healers who would wave their hands and change my money DNA and my ancestral connections and blah, blah. And I'm making $100 a month, no matter how beautiful my vision boards are and my affirmations and I and the tagline and the website and the business card. So what? And even that $100 client looked like she was going to go. So it was after that seventh, being stood up that seventh time, that I burnt and crashed. I despaired. Mm. And I just ran out of hope, which is a very dangerous place to be. Mm. Where I remember just getting on my bed in my tiny little apartment and lying down and screaming and crying.
How long had you been doing it at this point?
I had been pursuing coaching as a paying gig for between a year and 2 years. I had been coaching for free for 6 years. Hmm. I had gone through my actor period and I started coaching as a sort of a, as I would describe it, a vacation for the soul. Because it was a vacation from all that neurotic self-obsession of being an actor. It was like, I get to focus on helping other people. Oh my God, that feels so good.
I was going to ask you actually, so what happened with the acting? Because you went from religion, law, acting, which is not the usual.
Well, I never actually pursued the legal thing. I scored so well. So I started training other people to become, to take the law school admission test. And one of them actually clerked for Ruth Bader Ginsburg and has done very, very well. But yeah, I got a few boyfriends into law school, just training them how to take the test. So I was having these really miraculous results with actors, writers, directors, and producers who were paying another company that I volunteered for and I coached for, and they were having breakthroughs. And after about 4 years of that, I was like, oh my God, I am suddenly getting all this acting work and I'm hate the jobs I'm booking. I don't like who I am, being this picky, negative, neurotic, insecure actor person lying about her age. I don't want to do this anymore. I wonder if I can make a living helping people, because I'm like getting all these people who are becoming movie stars. Mm. Would somebody pay me for that? And I asked around and found out, why, yes, there's this profession. People do it for real. And one of my clients actually had been a professional life coach, had been an actor, became a professional life coach, was working with me to go back into acting. And he pointed me to his coaching school. So I thought, well, that's easier than putting up a sign and charging money. I'll go to school and then I'll feel so confident I can stick up a sign and charge money. So I went to school, took me a year, hundreds of hours, got my certification, got a bunch of testimonials, more. And I still didn't have the confidence. So I got some more certifications, thinking if I get this, then I'll have it. It was an inside thing. It was, and it came out of that day of despairing, just wailing, screaming, crying my heart out on the bed, feeling completely tricked and betrayed and hated by the universe. Because I'd been really pursuing this for so long and doing everything, not only not making money, but spending money on more classes and travel and all that kind of stuff, getting more and more in debt, not getting anywhere. And I felt doing everything I was told, and it didn't matter. And I was out of hope, and I just felt hated. I hated the universe back. I did not want to be alive. I was just, what's the point? I can't take care of myself. What's the point? And so it was that combination of fear and rage and hurt. I just felt so hurt. And when I cried myself out, truck going by, I got curious what was inside of me that couldn't be with money. It felt like I was pushing it away. And why was that? And I got curious. And I had a session with my coach the next day, which is ridiculous because I didn't have enough money for food or for housing or for insurance or for anything, like even for like internet. But I had a coach, a really good coach. Thank goodness. Because, and I've been working with him for months and nothing was changing, and it wasn't his fault. But that day I came at like such a low point. And it inspired something in him. So by the way, any of you working with coaches who, I see this so often, people want to be on good behavior when they come to a coaching session. Don't. give your coach stuff to work with. So this session with my coach inspired him to ask a really weird question that he had never asked before. Came out of the blue and it changed my life. And he heard the pain that I was in, and he spontaneously asked me, if your money was a person, who would your money be? And I saw my money person instantly. By the way, I am a terrible visualizer. If you take me on a guided visualization and I'm supposed to sit by a river, I will spend the next 45 minutes trying to pick the river. But when you're in so much emotion, it overrides your intellectual, controlling, conscious brain, which is a good thing. So because I was like in such a place, and I was so surprised by the question that before I could start analyzing it, I saw the person. And my money person in that moment was this big, scary, dirty, violent biker who caused fights and terrified me. And I could imagine myself being at a live event with this biker, this bad guy, nothing wrong with bikers, this one. And I would have my eye on him constantly for the purpose of creating maximum distance between the two of us. And that was like my big light bulb moment. That no matter what I was doing, no matter how many awful networking meetings I went to, no matter how many emails I sent out, no matter how many phone calls I did or meetings I took or brochures I printed, no public speaking, no matter what I did consciously, every cell of my being existed to create maximum distance between me and this threat who was my relationship with money. And there was no way that I could have money in my life if it was this guy. And I knew that I had to get rid of him. And I'm going to pause. I never script, so I jump around. But here's what I didn't know at the time that I was having my own transformation that I know now, having coached thousands of people through this very successfully and many, many clients making multiple millions of dollars doing this process. It's never about money, really. Like, money is so dramatic in human existence, not because we decided to invent money. Money is so dramatic because money represents really big things, like the big things in our human existence. It's like the soft, white, underbelly, tenderest, most vulnerable parts of us. It represents power or our powerlessness. It represents love. Are we loved? Are we lovable? Are we wanted? It represents worth. Are we worthy? Do others consider us worthwhile? And safety. Like, are we expendable? Are we cannon fodder? Here in the States where you pay for healthcare, it's like you have to pay for your right to exist. Mm. You have to pay for food and shelter and all this kind of stuff. So it's like really heavy stuff. So when we don't have money, it's an existential threat. It puts us in a panic. And when we receive money, we feel fed and loved, almost like we're being held by mom, you know, we're wanted, we're secure. And these are really huge feelings. So when I talk about why we protect ourselves from money, if you're doing everything you're supposed to be doing, if you are giving value, if you are helping people and you're not making money, and especially the healers, because I'm talking to you. You want to help and you want to heal. And if you aren't making money for this amazing gift that you give, you've got a values conflict and you've got a monstrous relationship with money. And you're not inventing it. We've all seen terrible stuff going on. Like, I know this podcast is evergreen, but the moment we're having this conversation, Russia is invading Ukraine and it's horrific, you know? And there's always economic motivation behind any war. And we've got pollution, climate crisis, animal abuse, human trafficking, all sorts of really bad stuff motivated by money. And by the way, the oligarchs are frightened too. Nothing is ever enough.
Oligarchs, what's that?
Oligarchs are the people who have billions of dollars. Oligarchs are the people who, like the very top mega wealthy, are afraid of losing what they have. Mm. Because they're human beings, and the human experience has a lot of fear in it. And when there is no enough, no matter how many billions of dollars a person has, or millions or hundreds of millions or whatever, when there's no enough, that's fear. So that person has a money monster too. Hmm. And that's something that I learned from coaching a lot of people from every income range. In the beginning, I thought it was just people who don't have money, but I have coached billionaires. And it's just a continuum of the human experience of fear or moving towards love, great lifestyle, and a wonderful legacy. And anything that gets in the way of love and a beautiful lifestyle and a wonderful legacy that makes the world better for everybody, anything that gets in that way is monstrous. And I believe money is to serve love, lifestyle, and legacy. So I had the biker dude, and I had to get rid of him. And the reason I'm talking about what money represents is because when you do this for yourself, you will start with negative things that you've seen or personally experienced related to money. You will start there. But that's not usually where I find the monster. Even my first time, the monster, more about money, it was about the fights in my family. Family members who betrayed each other, never spoke to each other again, that I was cut off from. It was about feeling alienated from other people. It was about feeling not good enough and rejected and crushed and all that kind of stuff, because that's the stuff we feel. So you want to look at anything that has ever made you feel unloved, unworthy, or unsafe, especially if it doesn't look like it has to do with money on the surface. You just want to build enough of a feeling that life doesn't love you, doesn't value you, and you're not safe here. So all of my law of attraction friends, if you're freaking out right now, mm-hmm. take a deep, as my husband would say, take a deep and cleansing breath. Take off your law of attraction hat and go into the opposite. I call this alchemy. Alchemy is the transmutation of lead into gold. It's like a slingshot. We are creating tension to catapult you where you want to go. But first we go in the wrong direction because we want to separate the lead from the gold. When it's mixed up, you just have mud and you're stuck and nothing changes. So we want to go deep into the leaden human experience because that's what motivates and creates the energy for the transformation. And when you are afraid you're going to be living on the street or some other scary situation, you can affirm your way from here to eternity, and it's not going to change anything. Affirmations, positive thinking, vision boards, not enough. There was a scientific study on this from the University of Wales back in 2009 that affirmations made people feel worse because you haven't addressed the root cause, the underlying condition. It's like if you get a snake bite, you don't put a Band-Aid on it because then the poison is just going to go inward and go to your heart and kill you. So what you need to do is we need to suck it out. And the way you suck it out is by digging it up. So it's in your face. That's step one. Step two is now you're going to blame it on some imaginary person that is not you and not your parents. So it's going to be, you can use Hitler, you can use whoever your boogeyman is. It can be somebody totally imaginary, but it's somebody that's like, ooh, that's bad, terrifying. It feels totally personal. It's like he has it out for me. He's thinking horrible things about me and he wants to do terrible things to me and he made the world a bad place and he's got to go. Like my mother was a fan of Highlander. There can only be one. You may not be old enough for that, but
I remember Highlander. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, only one of you gets to survive. So I recommend you choose you and you destroy the monster. Like back in my first round, we just broke up. After having coached enough people to see what works, I would say, blow it to bits and leave no bloody parts that can reconstitute into some like monster zombie, just like eradicate it, blow it up. Melt all the leftovers, suck it up into a cosmic vacuum and just have it gone.
And this is something you're doing by yourself, unless obviously you work with somebody like you. So if somebody's listening to this and they're thinking, well, okay, this all sounds very good and I've tried loads of different things. You know, I've done RTT, I've done NLP, I've done all of this sort of stuff. What does it look like? You said you've really got to feel into it, which I get because obviously, you know.
It's going to look different for every human being. Mm. I just did back in September. Once a year, I do my money goddess, my ultimate money goddess experience retreat. And I usually do it in Bali, but during the pandemic, I'm doing it in Mexico. And one of the women there was 45 minutes. And one of the women took 6 hours, which has never, ever, ever happened. And that was my 11th retreat. That's the only time it's gone that long. But it's what she took. She wasn't wrong. It's what was necessary for her. And all the other women were going through it vicariously while she was going through it. And by the way, she made $1.2 million between September and February. So it was worth the effort. That was how big the change needed to be for her. So it's going to be different. What makes it work is how big you, how deep you go with the root cause. Be willing to go into those uncomfortable places. You do not need to re-traumatize yourself. You do not need to dissociate. You do not need to go that far. You need to go far enough that it's like, this is hideous, and I'm motivated to change this no matter what. And then you have to make the personification, the monster has to feel so real that it's like a real person. That's what gets it out of like, oh, this is an interesting idea. Like you and I could talk about negative money beliefs and positive money beliefs for 30 hours and nothing changes because we are not engaged on a really deep emotional way that really literally rewires the brain. That's part of neuroplasticity is you need to engage at that depth. To like fire the synapses and have an emotional response to the trigger that you can then replace. So, but you need to really feel it, smell it, see it, hear it, all of, you know, all your senses engage so that this bad guy seems really real to you. And the bigger and the badder, the better. And then you have to make a decision that you will destroy it with whatever imaginary tools, weapons, whatever you have. And I know that my crowd tends to be very, very love and light.
Yeah.
And so what I would say is draw on spiritual warrior archetypes, because that can be sacred too. It's like Goddess Durga of India or Kali slaying ignorance. And you are slaying everything that you reject in your life experience that goes, it's like you do not get to stay here and you do whatever you need to do until it is so gone that it's like, whoa, this feels like something I've never felt before because it's gone for the first time in my life experience. And it creates like an empty hole, a vacuum, which is what I got when I got rid of the biker. Now, because I didn't blow up the biker, but it doesn't matter. You need to do this anyway. I was afraid he was going to come back. So I thought, okay, I need a new relationship with money post haste, right away. And I didn't want to get into another abusive relationship. This is what's so great about making money a person is if we've had bad relationships, I have a frame of reference for that. Yeah. And I really knew that I didn't want that again. So I asked myself, well, who could I want so much in my life that I'd be willing to have this person in my life, even if it was money, because the person is so awesome. And that's the way you have to put the love first. It can't be a what have you done for me lately, money, cash, whatever, because then you become the helpless baby and the money becomes a monster again who holds all the cards. You have the body. We want to have you have all the power. So I asked myself that question, and who showed up was this tall, dark, handsome, adorable young man, super safe, super clean, super romantic, all dressed up in a tuxedo and a bouquet of red flowers. I don't know where that image came from, but it was wonderful.
A fantasy.
Right. By the way, and I had a boyfriend that I was madly in love with. And I mentioned that because I get this all the time. And I love this feedback. Oh my God, Morgana, I'm worried that I'm cheating on my human person with my imaginary money, honey. I get that all the time. And that is like, you're doing great. And you cannot have physical intimacy with your imaginary honey. But your human will really appreciate this energy that you're bringing to the relationship. And it'll be good for your human relationship. By the way, this is one of the reasons why I recommend that your money honey not be a cat or a dog or a horse.
Right.
And also, probably not Jesus or Gandhi or Shiva, maybe, because Shiva is smoking hot. But you want to be able to feel like you can be equals, and you want to be able to see yourself through the eyes of the lover, because that's when you see yourself as you really are, like your best self, without all your neuroses that are not you, all your circumstances that are not you. You see yourself as the gorgeous divine being that your money honey sees. And you feel the love of this other being for you, and how you feel in the world changes. And if you've never had a good relationship in your life with either a lover or family, this changes your relationship blueprint. Because your money loves you, and your money is going to want you to only be with people who love you too, because that will make him happy. Or her, or they. Whenever I say he, believe me, I have coached everybody. And just insert the gender of your joy. So I meet this cute guy. I can feel how much he loves me. I can feel how much he wants to be with me. And I realize I don't know how to let him be with me the way he wants to be, because I have trained myself over the years to push him away. I don't know how to not. So the convenient thing about money being a person, and a cute person, and a person in love with me, is if I ask, he'll respond. So I ask him, what do you need from me so that you can be with me? By the way, because this mistake comes up all the time, and I'm just told you, I'm just going to try and do as much good as I can in the little tiny time we have. So I'm not trying to hold back any secrets. I'll give you as much as I can, knowing that I'm trying to cram 20 years into 45 minutes or so. But asking, what do you need from me so you can stay with me, is not asking, what do you need from me to love me? When you do this, the number one rule of your money honey is your money honey loves you unconditionally. Doesn't mean your money honey will stay with you unconditionally. And if you think of what it's like when you love somebody and you watch them self-destructing, and you can't do anything about it because they are so committed to hanging out with people who are unkind or disrespectful or dangerous to them. When you see somebody harming themselves and you love them, it's very hard to be with. Or if you love them, but they reject you and push you away, very hard to be with. Doesn't mean you love them any less. So when I asked my money, what do you need from me to stay with me? The first answer I ever got from him was, I need you to love me and stop treating me like a monster. And I got how sweet that answer was, and how much pain I caused him. And I didn't want to cause him pain, because he was love. Seriously, when you slay the monster, all that exists left is love. Mm. So I said, okay, that seems more than reasonable. Okay. And so what does that look like? And we had a conversation, and I made a commitment the next time he brought me a gift, which usually looked like somebody wanted to pay me and hire me, instead of going, ooh, like the question that would freak me out was, how much do you charge? Or a euphemism that I didn't figure out, when they say, how do you work? They mean, what do you charge? Instead of freaking out as if I had some like horrible, shameful, stinky monster that I didn't want anyone to know about. Instead, when they asked me what I charge, I would say, this is what I charge, with this energy of love and gratitude and appreciation for the cute guy. And I got to try it out immediately. Like with the, by the next day, four people had reached out to me and wanted to hire me. And I had four conversations. And four people hired me at double what I'd ever charged before. And they kept coming and they kept coming. And I started having waiting lists and doing groups and writing books and creating audios and doing podcasts and stuff like that to help more people. And I've made millions of dollars. And I'm the person who was struggling to make $100 a month. And really the difference is it's not a one-time relationship where it's like, I love you and you're good to go for the rest of your life. It doesn't work in my marriage. It doesn't work in this. It's more like, I will have a price point sometimes and it'll be great and feel fair and energizing. And then one day, ooh, it feels like I just betrayed myself. And I realize, oh crap, it's time to charge more. I've gotten bigger. I've gotten better. My results have gotten bigger. And for some reason, it's out of integrity to stay at that price point. So it goes, so my money and I will have a conversation about it. And he'll tell me what he thinks I should charge. And I'll go, oh no, I could never do that. And we'll just negotiate back and forth until, you know, we find the number we can both agree on. So for anybody, especially my healers and my artists and my do-gooders of the world, that's how I set fees. It's not personal. It's not how much I'm worth. It's not how much you're worth. It's what is the value of the transformation? And what is my money, honey, who does not have any of my neuroses and insecurities? Because how you feel about yourself being a human being is going to vary wildly from minute to minute to minute. So my money, honey, is kind of outside that vortex, and we'll have a conversation and then we'll come to a mutually respectful of the work. It's not even about me. Agreement and number, and that will just be my fee. And then I can have a conversation. I can look at what somebody needs. If what they need is something I'm good at, I will give some choices of how we can work together, and then they can decide because they're grownups. I'm really not an advocate of closing. All that, you know, how to overcome objections. If somebody objects, respect their no. What a concept, right? respect their boundaries. If they have some concerns that you can discuss, fine. But that's, I understand that I'm in a very comfortable position now. I know what it was like when I wasn't. And in the beginning, you take anybody you can get and you learn what you're good at and you learn who your people are, learning to walk. And by the way, I know a bunch of my coaching peers will say, quit your job. J-O-B, that's just over broke. Honestly, if you're starting a business and you have a job so that you don't have to be scared and desperate about your next meal, and you can actually just have a conversation to see if this person is somebody you can help who wants your help, I like that breathing space. I think that's a good place to start. And gradually, what will happen is your confidence and your expertise will develop to the point where one day you'll take a look at where your income is coming from. Again, have a money, honey, have a great relationship with money so that you can serve, love, and make money simultaneously. And what will happen is one day you'll notice, oh my God, I'm making so much more money from my private practice. Having that job makes no sense at all. And that's when you let it go. I believe that, you know, if making money is playing on one team and every, you know, love and value and healing and everything you care about is playing on the opposite team, everybody loses. So you need them on the same team. Mm. And that's when you no longer need to protect yourself from money. By the way, I did the same process on my relationship with love when I was 45 years old and single and never married and had a perfect 100% track record of romantic failure. Yay. And I've been looking for my soulmate since I was four or younger anyway. Seriously, when I chased Brian Patterson under the piano on his fifth birthday, and he remembers, which is really humiliating. So I was like teaching what I'm teaching here and hearing myself going, well, you know, if you're doing everything right and you really want it and it doesn't make sense that you aren't making any progress, you're probably protecting yourself from what you want. And I had one of those moments of, oh, crap. That sounds like love. So I came up with and slayed a love monster that was bigger than any money monster I ever had. And I met my husband, Devin, 2 months later. And then when I was 47 and I was leading my money goddess retreat in Bali and he was on a photo shoot in South Africa, he proposed to me over Skype.
Nice.
It was perfect. It's perfect for us. And we eloped and I thought, oh, that's it. At that point, it's like, I am 47. That means if we're going to have a big wedding, choosing the venue and the caterer and the music and all of that crap is on me. And I don't want to do that. Mommy and daddy aren't going to do that. I don't want to do that. Let's just elope. I just want to be married to you. And I thought, okay, done deal. Bucket list done. And 2 weeks later, we went down to Puerto Vallarta because my husband, among his, you know, multitude Renaissance man talents, is a travel writer, and he was assigned a trip to Puerto Vallarta. He called the tourist office and said, hey, can I bring my wife? I just got married. They said, yeah, make it a honeymoon. So we did. And we went down to Puerto Vallarta and we were walking by their iconic cathedral, Our Lady of Guadalupe. And my husband thought it would be just a funny goof if we got married again and just walked into this cathedral all sweaty, filthy, and disgusting in our flip-flops and our, you know, tourist clothes. So he said, hey, want to get married again? And I said, absolutely. So we walked in, took off our rings, stood at the front, and he made up new vows, and I made up new vows, and it all hit me so much deeper because I now I had some experience of what it's like to be married because I've been married for 13 days. And I started tearing up and crying, and it was just so deep and romantic, and people were like in the pews cheering. And that's what gave him the idea that maybe this wasn't such a goof. Maybe we just need to intentionally pause life over and over again and look at each other and say, you're my priority and I choose you. You're my partner. Here's why. Here's what I want for you. Here's what I want to bring to the relationship. And we just make that. I want to say, I don't know if I'm allowed to curse.
Yes, you can. Yeah.
Okay. We just make that shit up every time.